This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 101. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I am Jim Harmer, and I am speaking with bad grammar, whatever you want to call it. My son would be correcting me right now. When you say 100, you say 100, 101, 102. If you put an and in there, it means that there was a decimal point, like it's 100 and 1/10. So you're not supposed to do that. But either way, you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world, and we're all here ready to nerd out for the next 30 or 40 minutes about photography and learn as much as we can. And to teach us all is my friend Darren Meller.
Hey Jim, how you doing today? I'm feeling kind of geeky.
Yeah, that's good. You've had a long flight to get your geekiness up ready for this.
Oh yeah, I've been up since 4 a.m. I flew out of Omaha, Nebraska into Phoenix, Arizona after shooting some senior photos over the weekend. So it's been go, go, go. And I procrastinated unpacking and probably running on about 4 hours of sleep. But I'm a photographer. I'm living the dream. So no complaints in my department.
Well, that's great. Well, let's talk about some of the things we were talking about before we started recording about your shoot for the senior portrait and also what you're shooting there in Arizona. So let's talk about a few of the tips that you learned there. First, when I looked at the photos from your senior portrait shoot, great photos, by the way, but the thing that stood out to me most is that soft wrapping light that I saw in the photos. And you said you were using studio strobes. And as soon as you said that, I thought, okay, that kind of makes sense. There's something about studio strobes that just has a certain look to it.
There is. Honestly, when my friend John first bought this video or the studio strobe, he bought it off Craigslist, got a great deal on it. And I went up to a studio and I said, what's the big deal about this thing? And I never had played with it. And then recently he invited me up there to do some shoots with him and his family. And I saw that beautiful light that was cast on him. And I said, I got to have one of these. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then the senior photo opportunity came up and it was a senior just, you know, last minute. I need to get that yearbook picture in by January 5th. Can you shoot it before you take off to Arizona on Wednesday? So we really quickly did it on Sunday, put all the lighting set up together, and I shot the Einstein for a second time. And my gosh, I love that thing. It is so nice the way it projects light on there, especially if you use a combination of some constant lighting to backlight them, but just the light that it spills over them. Oh, it's breathtaking.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I did love when I was shooting studio strobes is that just the big lighting modifiers. I mean, we're not talking about umbrella, like a typical, you know, rain umbrella kind of size. We're talking about three times that much size that we're putting on the light so that you can get that soft wrapping light. And there's nothing about a studio strobe specifically that's making the light look any different than, you know, a regular speed light that you can use, you know, just off camera on a little light stand. But the difference that I often find is after I left studio strobes and I came to speedlight world, because I didn't want to deal with all the weight of a studio strobes anymore, is once you're in speedlight world, it's hard to find those huge lighting modifiers for a speedlight. Because on a studio strobe, you know, it's big. It's like the size of a car battery, those flash heads. And it has a giant metal ring on the front. So you can attach a huge lighting modifier and support it. I mean, they're heavy, the big old lighting modifiers. And so it just makes it more practical to attach that. When you come to speedlight world, there's not that huge metal ring, and so it's more difficult for the lighting modifier manufacturers to make that huge, beautiful light, because what do you mount it to? You know, it's kind of hard to get that sucker on the lighting stand if you only have that little umbrella hole that you're attaching it to. And so, one, I think that's an area that we could see some huge improvement in manufacturing. Let's see a stronger attachment mechanism on light stands so that we can put on those big lighting modifiers. That's one thing. But then the second thing is, there's nothing different about the flash modifier. So if you can find those big lighting modifiers for a speed light, you're going to get the exact same quality of light. I mean, light is light no matter what it comes out of. It's just light. And so I think people that are shooting speed lights often never get into those big lighting modifiers and miss out on that beautiful wrapping light because it's just a little bit more cumbersome on these stands.
It is. And one thing that I noticed, I was listening to another photography podcast earlier in the week, and they were at the photo conference that happened recently in New York. And there was a gentleman they were interviewing from Westcott, and he was saying how they have a 7-foot shoot through white umbrella and how it was so nice just to be able to attach a speed light to it and spread the light over a big group. Because if you're using a smaller umbrella, it's going to cast shadows on someone in the group's face unless you're adding more speed lights. And I think it would just be a lot simpler to use a 7-foot umbrella like that, or use something like an Octabox or the biggest diffuser possible and stepping over to the speedlight world. But I can definitely see the advantages of, besides the weight that you're carrying around with a studio light. If I was going to be doing 95% of my work in the studio, I think I'd pick up an Einstein right away. But I like the versatility of speed lights, even though you did mention those drawbacks.
Right. And if you do look hard on Amazon, you know, look for the 50-inch, 60-inch kind of soft boxes, inches. I'm sorry, you're going to have to translate those into centimeters for those of you international listeners. I always try to be careful to remember to talk about the different sizes, but I don't know how to transfer that one over. But if you look for those big lighting modifiers, you can find them. They're just a little bit harder to find. Now, one tip I'll give you as you're looking for lighting modifiers, the big, beautiful ones, is don't go for the name brand for anything other than reliability and just how well built the product is. A lighting modifier is a lighting modifier is a lighting modifier. And as much as the manufacturers want us to believe you've got to buy the name brand, when it's, you know, a 20-inch softbox and it's just a square and it has a diffusion panel on the front, a 20-inch softbox is a 20-inch softbox. You know, can I say there's no difference at all? No, there are some differences. For example, if you look at a cheap lighting modifier, you'll see that it has kind of a hot spot in the middle. It doesn't diffuse it quite as well as some of the others do. But I've also seen that on expensive ones that do that. So there's not like a ton of engineering that goes into a 20-inch softbox. So if it's the same shape, you know, it's going to do about the same thing. So don't feel like you have to go for the name brand when you're looking for softboxes. But, you know, there are those tiny differences, like I mentioned about hotspots. But the other thing is durability. So the best way to know if a product is going to be durable is not from the name brand. It's from reading the Amazon reviews. So check the reviews before you buy a modifier, but just look for something really big. They're not very expensive. You can get a nice big modifier for, $80, $100. You can get something really nice and big, especially if you go with like a, you know, 5-foot, 7-foot umbrella, something like that. You know, those are very inexpensive to get. So check them out. Get yourself at least one nice, big, beautiful lighting modifier, and I think you're going to love the light that comes off of it.
Yeah, I can almost guarantee you're going to love the soft light that comes off of it, and it's just going to be a beautiful setup, and it's going to be a lot less time in post-production, because I learned the hard way by using smaller umbrellas that I had to go in there and adjust highlights and shadows individually on people's faces during one shoot just because we didn't place the right lighting modifier for the right situation.
Yeah, that's true. Now, to be clear, though, I don't, and I'm sure you don't either, Darren, use those huge lighting modifiers all the time. For example, if I'm shooting a wedding and I'm shooting, you know, the couple's formal pictures outside and we're going to do 20 different poses, there's no way I'm using a 5-foot, 7-foot umbrella. First of all, outdoors, that thing is going to be a sail and my photo assistant is going to be miles down the road. But the second thing is they're just cumbersome to use. You got to weigh them down. If there's any gust of wind, they break the spokes in them of the umbrella and then you got to buy a new one. They're harder to use. So it's really only when you want to, you know, work to get that one perfect shot, you know, you're doing a serious shoot. I love breaking out the big modifiers. But, you know, if I'm just shooting a wedding, I use just kind of a medium-sized softbox and keep it on a monopod. My assistant holds it on a monopod. Very easy to just walk around with. It's a lot easier.
Yeah, and speaking of walking around a lot easier and just being more versatile and nimble on your feet, that's another thing that I learned while traveling here early this morning to Arizona was how much less my dad and I put in our camera bags. One thing that we learned through traveling through Europe and traveling all around the world and all around the United States is that every time we keep packing, we're packing lighter and lighter, and it's making a lot more sense. Like, for instance, we said to each other, we don't need two of this lens. We don't need two of this lens. And if we need a backup camera body, I have that new Sony and we'll give it a shot. If we have two DSLRs break down and a Sony, then I guess we're out of luck and we'll be taking pictures with our eyes.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it is nice, even if you're not traveling with another photographer, to be able to split up your gear into different bags so that, one, if you lose a bag, you at least have another body. But like if I'm traveling with my wife, we'll kind of split up my gear into some in my bag and some in hers, because photo gear is really, really heavy. And so what we found the first time we went and traveled together is my bag was so heavy. I was just slugging through the airport and she was just, you know, walking around with her rolly bag. And I thought, wait a minute, she's got a rolly bag right there. Why do I have all this weight in my backpack? And so we've learned to, you know, kind of transfer it. So if I put some weight in a rolly bag, you know, it's rolling. It's not going to be like real hard to do. And I can keep my backpack a little bit lighter. So no matter, even if you're traveling with a non-photographer, just remembering to spread out that gear can really help.
Very true. And this podcast wouldn't be happening today if I didn't practice that by sticking my microphone and the sound recorder that we're using for this in my mother's suitcase, because there's no way I had room in my suitcase for everything I brought along with me with photography gear. So I can definitely empathize with that.
And speaking of podcasting, we are going to be making some big changes to the Improved Photography Podcast in 2015. What does Apple always say? It's the biggest change in the Improved Photography Podcast since the Improved Photography Podcast. What we're going to do is we're going to add new shows to the Improved Photography Network. We're going to add 4 new shows in 2015. The Improved Photography Podcast, how you're listening to it, is always going to be here for you. We would never give up on you. But we are adding new shows in addition to this one on different topics. A show just for landscape and nature photographers that'll cover night and wildlife as well. A show just for portrait and flash photography. And another show called Thoughts on Photography. And that one is going to be really cool. So let me tell you a little secret. I think interview shows are really boring. I fall asleep in them regularly. Whenever I'm listening to other podcasts, as soon as it's an interview, I'm like, oh man, I got to change the channel. And if you've noticed, we don't do a ton of them on Improved Photography. And, you know, like last week we had Tony Northrup on. It was awesome because we didn't talk about like his story. Where did you buy your first camera, Tony? We're just talking about some cool things that were going on. And that's kind of the idea of what we're going to do with this new show, is we're going to take a current event, something that's new and hot in photography that you kind of want to know about that's going on, and we're going to bring in the expert on that particular topic. So if we, you know, the story is that somebody sold a $7 million print, like we talked about last week, you know, Peter Lick sold a $7 million print, then we're going to bring on an art collector and talk all about how to get your photos in museums and selling your photos in art shows and that kind of thing. We're going to bring in the expert on that topic. If there's a big new camera announcement, we're going to go get the ultimate fanboy, you know, for that line of camera, somebody who's got it, who got an early, you know, an early release edition of the camera from the manufacturer or something. And we're going to talk about that for the whole show. The whole show is going to be dedicated to something, and we're always going to have a new expert on, but it's not an interview of their life story.
That sounds really cool. And if a monkey takes a picture of itself again with a photographer's camera again in 2015, then we can possibly have a lawyer on the show, right, to talk about the legality of the monkey taking a self-portrait, right?
Or a zoologist.
Oh, there you go. That'll work.
Anyway, we're going to have some great new shows coming up. But to do that, I need your help. Many of you are very knowledgeable photographers. You may not be a full-time professional photographer, but you're pretty knowledgeable when it comes to photography, and you eat up all the photography blogs and listen to all the podcasts, and you're the guy that I'm looking for, because we are looking to add a few podcasters to the network. Now, you're going to get some cool things by doing that. It's a paid position where we'll pay you to do the podcast. And also, you're going to be known with a lot of photographers. Improved Photography has a ton of people in our community. And so it's a really cool opportunity for somebody to step in and have an established audience with your podcast. And so if you're interested in podcasting for us, send me an email at podcast at improvephotography.com. Tell us what kind of show interests you, what you'd like to hear, some ideas for the show, and also kind of your experience. Let me know a little bit about you, and I'll get back to you about that. That's podcast@improvephotography.com. Now we need the rest of you. Those of you who tuned out when I talked about, very serious, knowledgeable photographer who's interested in podcasting, if that's not you, anybody who listens to the podcast, I'm looking for just some advice on direction to go. What do you like about the shows that we produce? What don't you like about the shows we produce? Wait a minute. That's ridiculous. Of course you like the shows we produce. No, just kidding. If there's something you don't like about the shows we produce, if you listen to other photography podcasts and there's stuff that they do that you like or don't like, let me know all of it. I'd love to hear your suggestions. Email me at podcast@improvephotography.com. I'm going to read through each one of those personally, and I want to get some good feedback from you guys, because that's the whole reason we're doing this, is so that we can better serve you with whatever area of photography you're interested in. Don't worry, Improve Photography is not going to change. You know, we'll make tweaks to make it better over time, but we're going to keep mostly the same format rolling forward.
And there is something exciting as well. Speaking of improvephotography.com, do you want to tell them what's going on in 2015?
Yes, we have three new editors on the website. So usually what slows down the website of getting new articles out is moi. It's the guy in the mirror, because we have a lot of great contributors that write articles for us, and I'm usually slow to read through them and edit it and publish them. So we have three new editors that are publishing tons of articles on there. And so definitely, especially starting January 1st, but even now, a lot of it has already started. Start tuning into the website just kind of as your daily routine. You know, when you wake up groggy and your cell phone alarm went off, you just go check the website. We're going to have an article up there for you. Almost every single day, there's going to be something. And on a lot of days, there are going to be two articles. So it's tons also, more content.
And it's also very, very helpful information. I read it every single morning, and that's not just because I'm a part of it, but the people who are publishing these articles, they're so well written, and they've helped me even as an established professional photographer.
Yeah, there's some great stuff going up there. So be sure to check out the website. We just published our 2014 doodad guide, in addition to the podcast that you listened on episode 100. Darren, me, and the editors of the website each published our favorite photography items of 2014. And, you know, kind of broke them down into the $50 items, $100 items, and then the who cares what price point items. And so go check out what kind of gear we're liking. That's been a really popular article so far.
Yes, and we have brought it up in previous episodes as well, but we are doing a ton of traveling in 2015 as well, too. We've talked about China. I think we've talked about doing the Oregon coast as well, and there's plenty more dates that are probably going to be filling up as well. So I always recommend that you go over to the improvephotography.com/travel group just to check it out, see where we're heading next. It might be in the neck of your woods, and we love meeting the listeners and also learning from you as we shoot alongside with you.
That's right. The Oregon group has filled up now. We have not been putting a cap on any of these trips. Just kind of saying, if you can come, that's great. But the Oregon group, like, it grew so big that it needed its own zip code. And so when we finally put a cap on it, we have 50 photographers going with us on the trip. It's going to be so much fun. I'm really looking forward to that one in February. April, we're going to go to Guilin, China. You can still sign up for that one. That looks like an awesome trip. Also, I just put up today, I think this one's going to go really fast because I'm only taking two photographers with me. I'm shooting a wedding on May 22nd and 23 in Boise, in my hometown, and I'm just going to invite two readers of the website to come and shoot with me. It's going to be an awesome experience because it's only going to be the three of us, so you're going to spend a ton of time with me, and we can work on your shooting, on post-processing, all kinds of stuff. We're going to shoot a real live paid wedding, which is going to be an awesome experience. And I'm also planning a really, really cool portrait photography shoot. I've had this one in the back of my mind just working over this concept since Dusty O. Dusty O and I sat down one day and we decided, all right, let's do a portrait shoot. And we got this concept together and we just couldn't quite put it all together, all the details that we needed. But just this last week, it's kind of been coming back to me. I've been thinking about it and I got this vision in my head of an awesome portrait. And so we're going to do that. We're going to get models together. So we're going to do that in the morning and then go out and shoot the wedding. It's going to be awesome, but only two photographers. And so definitely go to improvephotography.com/travelgroup and jump on that one quick if you're interested. We're also going to be hitting southern Utah and Arizona. We're going to be going to Maine, and we're going to go to a mystery international trip later next year. So definitely check that out. We have a bunch of stuff posted there. Well, Darren, we have three questions for today's episode. What do you say we hit them?
Sounds like a winner.
Hi, Jim and Darren. This is Adam from Oakland again. There's been a lot on your show recently about night photography. I have some questions about doing Milky Way landscape pictures. One thing I notice is that there's almost no perfect time to get the Milky Way bright and clean with the landscape also showing good detail. Something I'm trying to do now is blending two exposures, one for the landscape and the other for the starscape. So the questions for you are, do you have any suggestions how to do the capture so that I have images that I can fairly easily blend later in Photoshop? And the final question is, do your Photoshop classes, which I haven't taken yet, cover these techniques? I took your Lightroom class and I learned a ton, and I feel pretty comfortable with Lightroom now, but I'm wondering how to learn more about Photoshop.
The P got cut off there. So first of all, when you're blending two night photography shots together, really any photo, but especially it makes a big difference at night photography because the exposure is so delicate. What I would recommend is take the exposure of the landscape and take the exposure of the sky. And what I want you to do is to take the sky exposure and bring it down a little bit, and the land exposure and bring it up a little bit. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to match the exposure of the two photos right along that horizon line. If the exposure matches there, then it's going to just work. The whole photo is going to come together. It doesn't have to be perfectly matched, but it should be pretty close. I find that if you skip that step, if you can't get the exposures quite worked out on that horizon line, it's just never going to quite look natural. It's going to look like there's something weird going on that horizon line. So get the exposures, reasonably close, and then put the photos, one layer on top of the other in Photoshop, and then just make an adjustment mask, a masking layer, and then just paint black on what you want to conceal. Now, I have about a medium kind of softness brush when I go right over the horizon, and then I get a very, very soft brush, and with Whiten, you want to brush just a little bit of transition between the two, a little bit further away from the horizon with a bigger brush, and I find that works just great.
And is this what you did with your Iceland shot with the northern lights and the stars? Because I'm looking at that one currently, and I see the bottom of the landscape is very bright, and then we're still able to see the stars looking like little points in the sky with a nice shooting star in there, all of what it really encompassed with that question.
With that one, that's actually one single exposure. Okay. I very well could have done two exposures there, but the reason that I didn't need to do two exposures is I'm shooting on a very wide angle lens. And even though I'm stopped, I'm stopped way down, I'm wide open there at F4. It's still, everything is still pretty far away from the camera, maybe 10 meters away. And that's already infinity on that particular lens. You aren't going to see that on a 70-200, 10 meters away is not going to be infinity on a 70-200. But when you're on a very wide angle lens on a full frame camera, you're going to find that infinity happens quick. And so in that case, I didn't need to. As long as there's nothing really close to the camera, I'm usually just fine.
That's a great tip. I think that picture turned out well, and it's kind of cool to know that, we can either do it with multiple exposures or we can actually pull it off like you did with in camera. So that's awesome.
All right, let's go to our second question.
Hey, Jim. This is Dave Long from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Love your podcast, especially like the one on Lightroom presets, which I've bought both editions of, and would love to have more of a discussion on how Lightroom and Photoshop fit together. It seems like I do most of my stuff in Lightroom, and I'm wondering whether I need to get into Photoshop, and if so, what can I do, what can I not do in Lightroom that I need Photoshop for? Thanks very much. Enjoy your podcast.
All right. Well, this is a good question. I think that this is one that I get asked quite frequently for people who are just joining photoclasses.com or who shoot us an email at Improve Photography just to ask, you know, which direction to go. And I think that my understanding after using these programs for about a couple years now is that Photoshop came first and they both use the Adobe Camera Raw engine. So when you open up a raw file inside Photoshop and Camera Raw, you're essentially seeing the same sliders as what you're seeing inside Lightroom. But the cool thing about Lightroom is it is an awesome file management piece of software. And if you just let go, relax, and let Lightroom do the organization, it is so powerful. Where it's limited, in my personal opinion, is getting rid of scenes out of the image, like removing a tourist out of a beach scene, removing a trash can that happens to be a tangent in your photo in a street scene. Something along those lines is where you might need Photoshop. Or if you don't want to spend an expensive option, there's a program out there I recommended to someone recently called Snap Heal, and I believe it's available only on Mac, but it's about $9.99, and it'll remove power lines, trash cans, and people out of your photos and clean them up a lot. But I don't know. I think Lightroom is Photoshop's little brother, and it can do about 95% of the things that most photographers want to do with it.
Yeah, I agree. It's the little brother, but it's the fast, agile, fun, gregarious little brother. Photoshop is like the older, smarter, nerdier brother.
He's like Splinter off Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He's wise.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. And Lightroom is more of a Mikey kind of thing.
Yeah.
My kids have made me watch the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3 times in the theaters. And then we were watching a show on Apple TV last night, and the kids saw that it was out. And as soon as they saw it, they were like, "We're watching it." And I was like, "Oh, man." Okay, back to the topic at hand. All right, so yeah, the biggest difference for me is that Photoshop is going to allow you to do all the kind of graphic design stuff. Like if you want to just quickly change the size of the photo, much easier in Photoshop. You know, if you're preparing a photo to use on your website, you want to do a logo, something like that, all Photoshop. If it's graphic design, Photoshop is the right tool. Also, if you want to do any serious surgery to your photo, you don't want to just, you know, remove a pimple from somebody's face. You want to take their whole face and make it look like Barack Obama is on their shoulders, you know? Ah. You want to do some kind of serious surgery, that's when you want Photoshop. And Lightroom just doesn't have the tools to do that, because you can't have layers. You can't take two photos and smash them together in Lightroom. It can't do that. It's the younger, dumber brother. But saying it that way makes it seem like we prefer Photoshop. Not true at all. I use Lightroom way more than I use Photoshop. 90 to 95% of my work is all in Lightroom. There are certain processes that I go to Photoshop for still that it's just the right thing to do. When I'm working on the website and I want to get pictures up and resize them and stuff, all that happens in Photoshop. It's faster for that. But for just the photography stuff, Lightroom is going to do almost everything you want to do. Now, here's a note out to all of you. I know there are many, many, many of you, because I meet you all the time, who use Photoshop, who got Photoshop first. And every time you go into Lightroom or you hear about Lightroom, you say, "But I already have Camera Raw. Why would I buy a different program for this?" I promise you, you will not regret it. Just try Lightroom for a few months, spend a little bit of time in there every day, and suddenly it's going to click for you and you're going to say, "Okay, Jim was right. Lightroom is awesome." It's so much faster. The presets are something I use all the time. It's like I would hate to go back to doing any kind of portrait shoot without presets. It makes such a big difference. And I love having my photos so well organized as Lightroom does. It's leaps and bounds ahead of Bridge or what the Photoshop Elements organizer can do.
I concur with that. And also, if I had to make a bold prediction, I kind of see Photoshop Elements going the wayside eventually. I mean, right now, I think, and this is just me analyzing the market, I think that Adobe is trying to kind of market Photoshop Elements to those who are departing Aperture and those who don't want to dip their feet all the way into Photoshop or are scared of Lightroom or think it might be inferior or something. But I kind of see it going the wayside because they're already up to Photoshop Elements version 13 and they're not even really giving it time to mature and actually give people time to buy it, and because it's a retail box thing, it's not something you can get through the Creative Cloud like you can with Lightroom and Photoshop. So I see it going the wayside eventually with Photoshop Elements.
Yeah, I have been very surprised lately that Adobe's marketing has been very focused on Lightroom. You know, like if you install Adobe Flash on a browser, like I just reformatted and reinstalled my machine just to get a nice clean start of everything, and when I went to install Flash, it had all kinds of marketing stuff about, do you want to install Lightroom and try Lightroom? And I'm surprised by that because the average Joe has never even heard of Lightroom. In fact, a lot of newer photographers don't even know what Lightroom is. And so it's surprising to me that Adobe's pushing Lightroom so much, but you can see that they really believe in the product and they're committed to getting that into more hands.
I would agree. And we actually have that one more question about creating a printed photo book. So without further ado, let's listen.
Hi, this is Brent from Bridgeville, PA, about 5 miles outside of Pittsburgh, PA. It occurred to me that if I had a printed book of my work with me in my camera bag, it might open some metaphorical doors while I was out shooting. I could even open a dialogue that might result in an assignment. A printed book, even a small one, would show that I'm not just a guy with a camera. Rather, it would show that I have a particular level of experience in the field. Do either of you or your listeners have any first-hand experience with printed books, small ones enough to fit in a camera bag? Blurb, Shutterfly, Apple, and a long list of other retailers come to mind. But I'm more interested in quality of the presentation versus getting something done cheap. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
What do you think, Darren? Do you carry around a printed photo book?
No, I don't. I think with technology and everything, if I'm trying to show my personal work or the work of people who inspire me to try new things, I pretty much rely on technology and either use my iPhone or an iPad when I had one. I got rid of it after I got the bigger iPhone because I started using it less and less. But still, I would just carry that around and show them photos that way. And if they have any questions, I have a digital business card saved inside my folders and I can email them that or I can hand them a business card. But I just don't really see with my camera bag being so full to carry around a printed book. I mean, I can see where he's going with the manifestation of ideas and assignments and things along those lines. But for the most part, I think the inspiration comes before I even leave the house. And if I would do anything in print, I would print something probably by hand, maybe do a journal of my thoughts, my observations as a photographer. And then my goals is what I would like to accomplish within the next week as far as those observations and how I plan to expand upon them.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that this is quite a fit for me. I don't think I would carry around a printed photo book. Well, I know I wouldn't. But, you know, I can see the argument for it. And you know, if he's excited about this idea, you know, sure. I think it's a good idea. I've had good results from Blurb. But if I wanted to show my serious photography, I would probably go with ProDPI. They do photo books. I haven't checked their prices, and I haven't seen one of their photo books, and so I can't speak to that. But I can say that as a company, they do really good work, and I have done the head-to-head test of what did we have, like 8 or 10 different print labs that you can see the test at improvephotography.com/print test, and the results were really, really, really surprising. But ProDPI did the very best job on our print test. So I've got to think that their photo books are also pretty good. But I haven't personally tested them.
And I've actually printed books with the lab that came in second. I believe it was Miller's lab ProDPI. Mm-hmm. And their photo books are phenomenal. I'm actually doing one for that bride I've talked about in a couple episodes, and the way it's starting to come together, it's so beautiful. It's customizable, and if you want to carry that around to show your work, it looks great. It's great quality. I don't think you can really go wrong with either of those print labs.
Yep, very cool. Hey, well, that does it for our questions for today. I feel bad, though, that in the middle of the episode, we talked about the Improved Photography Travel Group, and I never made it clear. Those are all free. All those places that we're going to China, we're going to Southern Utah, we're going, you know, I'm shooting this wedding, and I'm inviting two photographers to come shoot with me. Free, 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 free. We're not charging for it. They are free photography workshops, and we're spending a lot of our own money and time to put these on all around the world, and we hope you'll take advantage of them. We're doing it for one reason. We want to spend some time with you. We want to understand a little bit about you and the kind of the things you're interested in photography. And we really want to give back and create a community feel around the website. So I feel bad that I didn't say that earlier to those. We always have new listeners coming onto the podcast. And so go check it out at improvephotography.com/travel group. And at the very end of the episode, I want to make a little bit of a personal note. This is the week of Christmas that this episode is being published. We're recording this on the Wednesday previous. And every year for the last several years, as Christmas has rolled around, I remember an experience I had a couple years ago when I was a law student. I was working and at the law school, and I was working in the tax clinic, and it came to Christmas Eve, and my client had delayed and delayed and delayed getting a huge box. I mean, like a big box of documents to us that I needed to work on for a tax issue that this particular client was facing. And, you know, the box came the day before Christmas Eve. And so I, you know, what else was I supposed to do? I had to get the work done. We were going to go travel right after Christmas to go visit family. And so it had to be done. And so I went in on Christmas Eve at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I started chugging it out. And the sun started to come up early afternoon, and I looked out the window, and I just thought, you know what? I will never, ever, ever, ever do this again. There's no way I'm going to work Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. There's no way I'm going to leave my family home and be working really anytime. I don't want the work to get in the face of the family, but especially on those days. And that's when it really became clear to us that to my wife and I that we were not going to do law as our long-term career, but it was time to do photography full time. And so I guess as my Christmas message to you, I just want to say that it really is a time that we have to sit down and focus a little bit on our family. And if you have let, you know, work and other worries and other things kind of get in the way of you and your kids and your spouse, that now's the time to sit down and figure out how you're going to stop doing that in the next year.
I think this time of the year is all about family. And honestly, I have all my camera gear out here. So does my dad for shooting Arizona. But if we come home with only a dozen photos and we come home with 10,000 memories, I think this trip is completely worth it. And honestly, that's what I think the message comes down to of what you said, is make sure you realize what's important in life and make sure that family is part of that, because they really are your rock. They're my rock. They're Jim's rock. And honestly, I couldn't get by without my family. So I really wouldn't take them for granted.
Well, Darren, Merry Christmas. Photo nerds all around the world, Merry Christmas. We look forward to serving you more in 2015. Hope to meet you out on a shoot. Bye.
Merry Christmas. Bye.
Merry Christmas.